Who is your best friend? Or what experiences of friendship have you had in your life that have been meaningful to you? Friendship can be a bit of a tricky thing, but it can also be a really deep and meaningful thing. One of the instances of deep friendship that I have seen in the last little while actually comes from the world of professional golf. And a documentary that was done on professional golf brought into the public's attention a golfer by the name of Joel Damon. He is ranked now somewhere in the hundreds in the world. So he's not the best golfer that's around, but he's certainly better than you and me. Joel Damon came into prominence because he's a lovable character. He was quoted in the first season of this documentary as saying, there has to be a 70th ranked golfer in the world, and it might as well be me. He had this kind of low-key attitude where he took things as it came. But his friendship with his caddy is what caught people's attention. His caddy's a guy by the name of Gino. These guys have been lifelong friends and gone through everything together. They joke around, they have fun together. Now, in the second season of this documentary, Joel Damon and Gino came into focus again because Joel Damon was having a real problem. He had lost the ability to focus, or he wasn't able to perform very well. He kept missing the cut at tournaments and had to go home early. He wasn't making a lot of money, and things were just really, really tough for him. And Gino, his caddy, was constantly trying to tell him, you need to work on yourself. You need to see a sports psychologist that can help you through this. You need to deal with some of your childhood trauma. And this was like eating him up inside to see his friends suffer so much and struggle so much. And he got to the point where he said, Joel, if you don't deal with this, I might have to find another job because this isn't really working for us anymore. And there's this scene where they're on an airplane and they're just crying, they're sobbing as they hug each other and they say, I love you and I'm with you. And Joel says, I'll talk to this guy. And Gino just gives him a big hug. And this is a really powerful scene of friendship, where two people are supporting each other through the struggles and trials of life. That kind of friendship is something that we all long for. But if you're honest, many of you who heard me at the beginning ask, who is your best friend? Some of you didn't really know what the answer was. I don't really have a best friend, or I don't really know, or I have people who say that they're my friend, but I don't know that I really can count on them, or I don't know how deep that friendship actually goes, or I feel a little tentative in this relationship with these people who I hang out with, but maybe we don't actually share anything very deep about our lives. Loneliness is an epidemic in our society. It's more and more of a problem. Loneliness actually has some pretty significant health implications to it as well. But yet so many people in our society are lonely, which is ironic given how connected our society now is with the technology we have. People are struggling in loneliness. So what we find as we continue in our study of the life of this Old Testament character we know as David, we find a really powerful friendship as a part of his story. And what we find is that a faithful friend is closer than a brother. And we see this in the story of David and Jonathan. So we're going to jump into 1 Samuel chapter 20 in just a minute. But first, let's just note where we've come from and where we're going. So David has been anointed as king by the prophet Samuel in the nation of Israel, but King Saul is still in charge. He has been unfaithful to God, and so God has said, you're not going to be the king any longer. But Saul is still holding on to power, and he's going to hold on to it in some pretty unhealthy ways. David was unknown in Israel, but he was proclaimed to be the next king. And then he started to get involved in the life of the nation. So his first job was to play the harp for King Saul. Saul had these kind of psychotic episodes where he was really angry and violent. And so David came in and played the harp and helped to calm him down. And then last week we looked at the story of David and Goliath. David goes to the battle lines. He's not part of the army, but he goes there and he hears that this giant Goliath is taunting the armies of Israel. And he says, I'll fight him because nobody else will. Everyone else is too afraid. And David steps up and kills the giant. So when we look at Old Testament stories, there are a few layers to these stories. Bill Arnold suggests that there's at least three layers we should pay attention to. One is, what's the universal interpretation? In other words, what does this story mean for the world? Secondly, what's the national interpretation? What does this have to do with the life of Israel, this nation that God is building and has chosen to bless the whole world? And then third, what's the personal interpretation for the people in this story and for us as people who read this? What's the personal or individual interpretation that we get from this? What is God up to on all of these levels? So we're going to key in on the personal as we wrap this up today and talk about friendship. But let's notice a little bit that's happening in the national and universal stories here. So let me summarize what happens in chapters 18 and 19. So chapter 17, David defeats Goliath and he starts to become popular. He starts to become well known. People start to know the name David and he goes out into other battles and he's very, very successful. And so people start to see David as this really successful and popular person. In fact, there's a note made in 1 Samuel 18 that the women of Israel are really enamored with David. Here's this handsome guy who is winning all these battles, and they start surrounding him with dancing and songs, and they come up with this little ditty that they sing as they dance. Saul has slain his thousands, and David his tens of thousands. So how does Saul feel about this? Saul is very angry. This refrain displeased him greatly. They have credited David with tens of thousands, he thought, but me with only thousands. What more can he get but the kingdom? And from that time on, Saul kept a close eye on David. And so Saul starts to try and kill David, actually. He throws a spear at him, trying to pin him to the wall. He misses, and David escapes. Then he takes a different approach. A promise King Saul had made to the person who killed Goliath was that they would receive his daughter in marriage. So Saul says, I'm going to offer my oldest daughter to David in marriage in order to bring him into the family. And if I bring him into the family, he's so involved, I'm going to send him out into all the difficult battles and the Philistines will surely kill him. So David gets this marriage suggestion from Saul and he says, who am I that I could marry into the king's family? I'm a nobody. And so he humbly declines that offer. And so Saul lets it go. But then he finds out that one of his younger daughters, a daughter named Michal, is actually in love with David. So Saul says, here's the opportunity again. He presents the offer to David. David again says, who am I? I'm a nobody. I can't marry into your family. So Saul says, well, how about you do something for me to prove yourself? And so Saul gives David the most unusual of challenges. He says, I want you to go into Philistine territory, and I want you to bring me back 100 Philistine foreskins. That's what I'd like you to get for me. So David goes out. Now, Saul's intention in this is that David is going to go in and get killed, right? Because no Philistine is going to voluntarily offer up their foreskin. He's going to have to go and forcibly circumcise 100 Philistine men. And so surely David will be killed as one of these 100 Philistine men put up a good enough fight to take down David. That's the hope of King Saul. Well, David goes out and not only does he get 100 Philistine foreskins, he brings back 200 Philistine foreskins and presents them to Saul. And Saul has to fulfill his obligation and gives his daughter Michal to David in marriage. Now, that doesn't stop his vendetta against David. He actually says to his servants, as soon as David comes out of his room in the morning, I want you to kill him. But Michal hears about this and helps David escape out the window during the nighttime. And so then in chapter 19, Saul's son and Saul have this conversation. And Jonathan, who's David's friend, which we'll get to in a minute, says, what are you trying to do to David? What's he done? And Saul says to Jonathan, you know what, you're right. I won't kill him. I will leave him alone. And then only a few verses later, Saul gets really annoyed with David again and tries to throw another spear at David and misses once again. And so David is on the run at this point. He's got to stay away from Saul. What's happening in the big picture here is that David, as God's anointed king, is moving towards his destiny as king. There are a few steps left to go. In fact, there's a lot of trouble yet to come. But he's moving towards where God is having him to be. King Saul, on the other hand, is stubbornly and pridefully holding on to power with both hands. And this is leading him in some very dangerous directions as he's desperate to cling to power. What's worthy of noting here, too, is that two of Saul's children, Jonathan and Michal, have now sided with David. They know that David is the one who will become the next king. This is very significant and very dangerous for them to do this. So chapter 20 then, we pick up the story of David and Jonathan. verses 1 to 4. Then David fled from Naioth at Ramah and went to Jonathan and asked, "What have I done? What is my crime? How have I wronged your father that he's trying to kill me?" "Never," Jonathan replied. "You're not going to die. Look, my father doesn't do anything great or small without letting me know. Why would he hide this from me? It isn't so." But David took an oath and said, "Your father knows very well that I found favor in your eyes." And he said to himself, "Jonathan must not know this or he will be grieved. Yet as surely as the Lord lives and as you live, there's only a step between me and death." Jonathan said to David, "Whatever you want me to do, I will do for you." Now we get a picture here of the fact that they're good friends already. This friendship started to develop earlier. We actually read about it in chapter 18, verse 1 to 4. After David had finished talking with Saul, Jonathan became one in spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. From that day, Saul kept David with him and did not let him return home to his family. That's David. And Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Jonathan took off the robe he was wearing and gave it to David, along with his tunic and even his sword, his bow, and his belt. So this friendship has developed. Now, we have to address the elephant in the room when it comes to interpreting this passage and this relationship in modern day. There are growing voices that suggest that David and Jonathan were in a homosexual relationship. And people say that because they read chapter 18 and they say, well, Jonathan and David, they loved each other as they loved themselves. And even in these verses, Jonathan takes off his robe, his tunic, and some scholars suggest he's practically naked by the time he's finished giving things to David. And so they suggest there's a sexual component to that. We could also look a little bit ahead into 2 Samuel chapter 1. Jonathan, rather, and Saul are killed in battle, and David laments that Jonathan is now dead. "How the mighty have fallen in battle. Jonathan lies slain on your heights. I grieve for you, Jonathan, my brother. You were very dear to me. Your love for me was wonderful, more wonderful than that of women." So, some people look at this and say this is a homosexual relationship in the Bible. How do we respond to that? Well, the first thing I'd say is that there is a principle in life that says what you look for, you will find. So if you are looking for a homosexual relationship in the Bible and you read the plain English of these verses, you could go in that direction if you want to. But I suggest to us that we don't necessarily have to go in that direction for at least three reasons. There are three good reasons why we don't need to think that this is a homosexual relationship. The first is the word love in Hebrew. This is a verb that is used a lot of times, and it's used in a few different ways. In fact, it's used in the immediate context of this story in a couple of different ways. So 1 Samuel 16, verse 21, David came to Saul. This is when David enters the courts to play the harp for Saul. David came to Saul and entered his service. Saul liked him very much, and David became one of his armor bearers. Saul liked him. This is the same word, same verb that is used in 1 Samuel 18. Saul loved David very much. Does this mean that Saul and David were in a homosexual relationship? Well, certainly not. 1 Kings chapter 5, there's another instance of this. Verse 1, when Hiram, king of Tyre, heard that Solomon had been anointed king to succeed his father David, he sent his envoys to Solomon because he had always been on friendly terms with David. Friendly terms there is the same verb for love. This foreign king had loved David. Were they in a homosexual relationship? Again, certainly not. So this word is actually broader. Secondly, this concept of love in the Old Testament often had practical and political implications. So when Jonathan takes off his tunic and his belt and he gives them to David, this is actually a sign that I am now loyal to you. I know, David, that you are going to be the next king of Israel, and I'm throwing my lot in with you. I will follow you, I will support you, and this is the sign of my loyalty. This is what this kind of love often looked like at that time. And then thirdly, when we think about marriage at the time of David, marriage didn't fulfill the same kind of functions as it does today. So if you were to ask me, who is your best friend? I'd say, well, my wife, Jenny, she's my best friend. But back in that time, when you were married, even if a husband and a wife loved each other, they weren't necessarily best friends. So it wouldn't be uncommon for a man to have a best friend in life outside of the marriage relationship that provided for relational needs in a way that we might think a husband and wife might more naturally do today. So there's a few reasons there why we don't need to think about this as a homosexual relationship. In fact, John Golden Gay says, in the modern West, we have gotten into such a mess about same-sex relationships that the very idea of a same-sex friendship has become imperiled. And Bill Arnold says something similar. He says, are heterosexual men incapable of such deep and abiding friendships? Such readings rob heterosexual men and deny them the right to have a loving yet non-sexual relationship with other men. So there's something here about a relationship, a same-sex relationship, friendship, that we should learn from Jonathan and David. And again, we don't need to think about this as a homosexual relationship. So let's carry on with the story then and look what this friendship actually will look like. Let's start reading again in verse 5. So David said, look, tomorrow is the new moon feast. Every month they would have a feast at the arrival of the new moon. And I'm supposed to go and dine with the king, but let me go and hide in the field until the evening of the day after tomorrow. If your father misses me at all, tell him, David earnestly asked my permission to hurry to Bethlehem, his hometown, because an annual sacrifice is being made there for his whole clan. If he says, very well, your servant is safe. But if he loses his temper, you can be sure he's determined to harm me. As for you, show kindness to your servant, for you have brought him into a covenant with you before the Lord. If I'm guilty, then kill me yourself. Why hand me over to your father? In other words, if I'm in the wrong here, you need to tell me. And if you're actually on your father's side, you should just kill me so I don't have to be killed by your father. Never, Jonathan said. If I had the least inkling that my father was determined to harm you, wouldn't I tell you? Now, we should reasonably ask here, shouldn't Jonathan know that Saul wants to harm David because it's happened already? Presumably the answer to that is Jonathan had this conversation with his dad where his dad assured him that he wasn't going to harm David, and Jonathan is taking his dad at his word. Verse 10, David asked, will you tell me if your father answers you harshly? Come, Jonathan said, let's go out into the field. So they went there together. Then Jonathan said to David, I swear by the Lord, the God of Israel, that I will surely sound out my father by this time the day after tomorrow. If he's favorably disposed towards you, will I not send word and let you know? But if my father intends to harm you, may the Lord deal with Jonathan, be it ever so severely, if I do not let you know and send you away in peace. May the Lord be with you as he has been with my father, but show me unfailing kindness like the Lord's kindness as long as I live so that I may not be killed, and do not ever cut off your kindness from my family, not even when the Lord has cut off every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth. So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David saying, may the Lord call David's enemies to account. And Jonathan had David reaffirm his oath out of love for him because he loved him as he loved himself. Then Jonathan said to David, tomorrow is the new moon feast. You will be missed because your seat will be empty. The day after tomorrow, toward the evening, go to the place where you hid when this trouble began and wait by the stone of Aitzel. I will shoot 3 arrows to the side of it as if I were shooting at a target. Then I will send a boy and say, go find the arrows. If I say to him, look, the arrows are on this side of you, bring them here, then come, because as surely as the Lord lives, you're safe. There's no danger. But if I say to the boy, look, the arrows are beyond you, then you must go because the Lord has sent you away. And about the matter you and I discussed, remember, the Lord is witness between you and me forever. So the things progress as they had arranged. The first day of the festival, David's not there. Saul thinks that David has a good reason to not be there. But on the second day, Saul is suspicious. He says, where is David? And Jonathan tells him this story. It's a lie, really, that they have concocted, that David had to go home to Bethlehem. And Saul is furious. He's very upset. Verse 30, Saul's anger flared up at Jonathan, and he said to him, you son of a perverse and rebellious woman. The language here is, you son of a whore. What a nice way to talk to your son and about your wife. Don't I know that you have sided with the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of the mother who bore you? As long as the son of Jesse lives on this earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Now send someone to bring him to me, for he must die. Why should he be put to death? What has he done? Jonathan asked his father. But Saul hurled his spear at him to kill him. Then Jonathan knew that his father intended to kill David. Jonathan got up from the table in fierce anger on that second day of the feast. He did not eat because he was grieved at his father's shameful treatment of David. So Jonathan goes out and he goes to the field. They do the little arrow thing that they have set up. And it seems like there is a moment at the end where it is safe for the two of them to come together and talk. Verse 41, after the boy had gone, David got up from the south side of the stone and bowed down before Jonathan three times with his face to the ground. Then they kissed each other and wept together, but David wept the most. Jonathan said to David, go in peace, for we've sworn friendship with each other in the name of the Lord, saying, the Lord is witness between you and me and between your descendants and my descendants forever. Then David left and Jonathan went back to the town. So let's think about this friendship that David and Jonathan had and what we can learn from it in our own relationships. This is an intentional friendship that is rooted even in the plan of God. Have you ever thought about that, about the people that you're friends with? C.S. Lewis in his book, The Four Loves, writes this. In friendship, we think we have chosen our peers. In reality, a few years difference in the date of our births, a few more miles between certain houses, the choice of one university instead of another, the accident of a topic being raised or not raised at a first meeting, any of these chances might have kept us apart. But for a Christian, there are strictly speaking no chances. A secret master of ceremonies has been at work. Christ, who said to his disciples, ye have not chosen me, but I have chosen you, can truly say to every group of Christian friends, ye have not chosen one another, but I have chosen you for one another. The friendship is not a reward for our discriminating and good taste in finding one another out. It is the instrument by which God reveals to each of us the beauties of others. I love that picture, that the people that are in your life have been brought there for a purpose. The friends that you have are there for a reason. God has put them there. And together, the friendship that you share is a blessing from the Lord. So there are at least three things that we can see in this friendship between Jonathan and David that would be instructive for us in our friendship. So let's look at them one at a time. First, a friend gives up their personal ambition for the sake of their friend. A friend gives up their personal ambition for the sake of their friend. Who is the next rightful king of Israel, given that King Saul is the king? Well, it usually works that a king's son takes the throne after his father either dies or abdicates the throne. So Jonathan is supposed to be the next king of Israel. As the son of Saul, this is his right as the heir to the throne. And yet he doesn't see this as something that he has to have. He doesn't grasp onto it as his father does. Saul doesn't understand this, right? When he's really upset at Jonathan because David is absent, he says in verse 31, as long as the son of Jesse, can't even use David's name, as long as the son of Jesse lives on this earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. In other words, Jonathan, don't you realize that if David is allowed to live, you will not sit on the throne? And Jonathan says, yes, of course I realize this. David is going to be the king. He's going to be the best king. He's God's choice as king. And so I am giving up my right in order to support my friend. He doesn't need to be the leader. And in fact, those who don't need to be the leader often make the best leaders. One of my jobs here at the church is to be a part of the discernment team. And one of the things that our team does is we discern who will be elders in our church going forward. And so we do an interview process, and one of the questions near the end is, if you are not selected as an elder, either by the discernment team or by the church, how will that impact your relationships and your place here in our church? And multiple times from multiple people, I have heard the answer, I will be just fine because I don't need to be an elder. I will serve as an elder if it will be helpful to the church, but I don't need to be a leader. These are people who have the right attitude towards leadership. They don't need to be the leader, but they're willing to serve. And in a friendship, this is a beautiful gift that you can give to a friend is, I don't need to be the one who is always pursuing my own agenda. I want to promote you. I will give up what is best for me so that we can have what's best for you. Sometimes these things, of course, aren't mutually exclusive. In fact, a friend who's always giving and giving and giving and giving and giving is actually maybe enabling somebody or in a codependent relationship. Jonathan receives just as much as David receives. Jonathan says to David, I'm going to support you, but I also need you to support me and my family. I need you to be kind to my family going forward once you become the king. And we're going to look in a number of weeks at the story of David and Mephibosheth, Jonathan's son, and how David fulfills this promise to Jonathan even after he's gone. So friends give up their personal ambitions to support each other. Secondly, friends celebrate success and mourn losses. Now, if we're really honest with ourselves, we are selfish even in our friendships. So this happened to me the other day. I have been playing golf for more than 20 years. And one of the things that I have never done playing golf is got an eagle. So an eagle is two shots under par. So if the par is five shots, an eagle is getting it in the hole in three. And so I have some friends who started golfing just in the last 2 or 3 years. And some of them went golfing just the other week. And I got a notification on my phone through a golf app that we use that tracks our scores saying my friend who just started golfing 2 years ago got an eagle on the par four 10th hole or something. And you know what my first thought was? How come he gets an eagle and I haven't got one yet? That's not fair. I caught myself pretty quick. I was proud of that, actually. Where I said, no, that's great for him. I can just be happy for him that he's succeeded, even if he's surpassed what I've been able to do in all this time. It's not a reflection on me and my skill and my value as a person that he's done this and I haven't. Let's be happy for him. And so I was, and I am genuinely happy for him. But sometimes we can have this attitude even in our friendships. Oh, you got a promotion and a raise? How great for you. How come I didn't get one? Or you live in this nice house. How come I'm still stuck in this small little apartment? Or you're getting married. How wonderful for you. How come I'm still single? Right? We can very easily turn things back to us. But true friends celebrate the success of their friends. They cheer them on when things are going well. They're happy for them. They stick with them no matter what. Proverbs 17, verse 17. A friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for a time of adversity. A friend loves at all times, whether things are good or things are bad. I think about some deep valleys in my life at multiple times, and I think about the people who were there for me in those moments, who stood with me, who helped in practical ways, you know, whether it was food or taking care of the kids or, you know, whatever it was that we needed at the time, but also just stood next to me in the midst of the difficulty and didn't leave. They cared for me in all kinds of different ways. This is a way how friends support each other in good times and in bad. They celebrate success and they mourn loss. They don't distance themselves when things get uncomfortable. They step in. Thirdly, a true friend helps the other find strength in God. 1 Samuel chapter 23. Verse 16 to 18, David is on the run now from Saul. As a very uncomfortable time in his life. Well, there's a moment where Jonathan goes to him and finds him. And this is what we read. Saul's son Jonathan went to David at Horesh and helped him find strength in God. Don't be afraid, he said. My father Saul will not lay a hand on you. You will be king over Israel and I will be second to you. Even my father knows this. The two of them made a covenant before the Lord. Then Jonathan went home, but David remained at Horesh. Jonathan went to David and helped him find strength in God in the midst of his challenge. Helped him find strength in God. He didn't just give him empty words. He didn't give him cliches or platitudes. He pointed him to God. One of the reasons why I became a pastor is because I do like to help people. One of the things I've realized in the last couple of years is that when I try to help somebody through whatever it is that they're dealing with in life, and it's not going well, they're not growing as fast as I want them to, I have at least two responses. One of them is to try to get super invested so that I can fix them. The other is to get angry at them because they're not growing as fast as I want them to. And if they only would do the things that I think they should do, they would get better, right? I've realized, though, that both of those approaches are actually rooted in my own insecurity and in my own need to feel successful in my friendships. And sometimes I think we have this kind of attitude in our relationships with our friends is we feel like we have to fix them. We have to get them from point A to point B. If they're going through a trouble in their marriage, if they're going through a difficult time at work, if they're having health problems or whatever, it's on me to get them through it. But really, a true friend realizes I can't fix my friend, but I can point them to God. I can point them to the one who truly can help them, who truly can help them get through this situation. And so I wonder, when's the last time that you pointed one of your friends to God? When's the last time you were talking about something that was difficult for them and you said, you know what, that reminds me of this verse in Scripture that encouraged me, or I've been praying for you and this is what I feel like the Lord was saying to me, or can I pray with you right now about the situation that you're going through? Because I don't have power to affect change, but God does. So a true friend will point their friends to God. So in all of these ways in which friendship is demonstrated between Jonathan and David, we can learn. My challenge, of course, will be this is what will help you become a better friend. Sometimes when we think about what makes a good friend, we wait for other people to show these things to us. Well, I'm saying we need to take the initiative in these ways in order to strengthen our friendships. Now, what to do though, because if loneliness really is an epidemic in our society, and some of you who are listening are like, I don't have a best friend. Like, what do you do with this then? Because you can't just go out today and conjure up a best friend out of thin air, right? This takes time. So these are principles that you're gonna have to put in place over a period of time and take a risk maybe to step towards a relationship and say, perhaps this could be the kind of friend that will help me in life and that I can help them in life. But in the meantime, I do want to give you this, and I know this is going to sound like a cliche. Okay, I know it's going to sound cliche, but the thing about cliches is there's truth in cliches. That's why they kind of last. But if you're struggling with friendship, and even if you're not in this world, Jesus is the truest friend that we can find. Jesus is the truest friend that we can find. Jesus talks this way in John chapter 15, which is really quite surprising that the God of the universe would speak about us, the people that he created, in these kind of terms. John 15, verse 13, greater love has no one than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. You are my friends if you do what I command. I no longer call you servants because a servant doesn't know his master's business. Instead, I've called you friends, for everything that I learned from my Father, I've made known to you. So Jesus says we are his friends. How? Well, first of all, greater love. There's no greater demonstration of love than to lay down your life for your friend. And Jesus was about to go and lay down his life for you and for me. So in doing this, Jesus is declaring himself and showing himself to be the greatest kind of friend, who gives up himself for the sake of his friends. Second, Jesus says, if you obey my commands, then you are my friend. Now, this makes it sound really conditional, but I think what Jesus is getting at here is, I have offered my friendship to you. I will know your friendship towards me if you obey the things that I've commanded you to, because these are the commands that lead to life. And then thirdly, Jesus says, you are my friends because I've let you in on the secrets of this world, the mysteries of this world from God, the truth of God and how this universe works and the salvation plan that I am bringing. I have let you know about all of this. So you're not like a servant to a master because a servant doesn't know what the master is up to. You're like a friend because we speak face to face about these things. Jesus demonstrates the kind of love that is described between Jonathan and David. This word in Hebrew is used all throughout the Old Testament. It's used between Jonathan and David and between God and his people. It's the word hesed. Hesed is this like gigantic word in the Old Testament that carries with it a surplus of meaning. It just overflows with meaning. In fact, usually when it's translated into English, the translators use two English words because one is just not enough. So there's phrases such as unfailing love, everlasting kindness, committed faithfulness, unending loyalty, extravagant grace. This is hesed. This is the kind of relationship that God has with his people. It's the kind of relationship David had with Jonathan. It's the kind of relationship Jesus offers to you. So no matter whether you find yourself in a wonderful friendship with another person here on this earth or not, the friendship of Jesus is offered to you. So my prayer is that you will experience that and that you will exemplify, demonstrate, live out the kind of friendship of Jesus in your relationships with other people. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you that you love us with this hesed kind of love. A love that's never failing, a love that never stops, never has an end. Thank you that you demonstrate this to us and help us to be people who demonstrate this kind of love to others. Lord, for those of us who have these kinds of friendships already established, may we exemplify the kind of friendship that honors you to one another. And Lord, for those who are hearing this but are lonely and don't have this kind of friendship, would you provide for them? Would you give them courage to take a risk, to step out and have a coffee with someone or invite someone over or to find that kind of relationship that will be so life-giving for them. We pray for your provision in this way. And we love you, God. We pray this. Amen.